Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As the memorial service for the Dallas police officers gets underway during this hour, and we will keep track of what the president has to say about so many issues, we wanted to speak to somebody who speaks well and from the heart on many of the issues that we'll be discussing this hour. So we called Clarence Page, and he agreed to join us this hour. He wrote a recent column, If All Lives Matter, Show That You Mean It. We'll discuss that. We will discuss the police shootings in Minnesota and in Louisiana and the terrible shooting of five police officers who died and others were injured in Dallas. We're reeling from all of this, and the debate is becoming pretty nasty, and it's hard to be able to bridge the gap between, as the Dallas police chief called, the two brotherhoods, black and blue. So how do we do that? Clarence Page is with us this hour to help us understand what's going on, understand all of these issues of violence, the divide between the police and the African-American community, the protests that have taken place, the proliferation of guns. The Washington Post had an interesting column today, actually, their editorial, so about that good guy with a gun. Things are in bad shape in this country at the moment, and Clarence is here to help us along. He is the 1989 Pulitzer Prize winner for commentary. He's been a columnist and a member of the Chicago Tribune's editorial board since 1984. His column is syndicated nationally by Tribune Media Services. His most recent book is The Culture Warrior, Selected Columns from 1984 to 2014. He's also seen extensively on TV as a political commentator. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Clarence. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, Clarence. Thank you very much for being with us. Hi.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you on. What a horrible week this has been. All of these divisions, Clarence, all of these shootings, all of these guns, all of this political animosity. It's just hard to find a ground where we can talk about how to keep killings from happening, isn't it?
It is, and I think it's really complicated by the fact that we're in an election year.
Right.
And in the summer of one of the most divisive elections I've seen in my lifetime, and this means that every issue is politicized on a different level, kind of gets pumped up with steroids. We have been debating the issue of police brutality and conduct versus support the police, et cetera, for a half century now. You know, go back to this is very much like the Nixon campaign back in '68, Nixon versus Humphrey, where law and order became a big issue. You know, we had hundreds of civil disturbances and riots going on around the country there during the Vietnam era, the Black Power era.
Right.
And now we're going through it again. And I couldn't help but think about the irony here of what's going through President Obama's mind now. Here, he came into office 8 years ago on a big cloud of hope,
right.
And change. You know, it was a joyous occasion in the Washington Mall, because even for conservatives and Republicans, it was an acknowledgement that America is still a land of opportunity, and people felt really upbeat. Now, Gallup, which polls public opinions on race every year, said they are now at the across the board, people feel worse about the racial situation in America now and are genuinely worried than at any time in this Gallup poll, which began in 2001. And that's it's obvious why. And also the biggest plunge came in the last couple of years, since Ferguson and other disturbances over this issue of police conduct, Black Lives Matter, et cetera. And it's, nobody expected President Obama to solve all of our racial problems, but just symbolically and otherwise, there was this a promise and dream surrounding him that folks were thinking, boy, if anybody could help us to move ahead, this guy can help us do it. And, you see what happens. It's quite possible now his legacy can be tarnished by the fact that in the last year of his presidency, we had all of that's going on. You know, the five police killed in Dallas, and the various disturbances around the country, and the controversial killings in Minnesota and Louisiana. So it's very it's disturbing for me, and you know, it's like deja vu all over again in so many ways. And I have to keep myself optimistic and try to rise above the feeling of being going through this whole thing over again, and like a nightmarish recurring vision.
Mm-hmm. So why is it all happening now, Clarence?
I think it's a combination of things. For one thing, a big reason is video. I think we've discussed this before.
Right.
You know, the fact that everybody's got a TV camera or TV station in their hip pocket or purse. Just whip out your smartphone and you can take video. And now people are seeing what many African Americans in particular have been complaining about for years, a presumption of guilt in police stops and the kind of conduct. The worst, I think, was the Laquan McDonald case in Chicago. Laquan McDonald was a teenager who may have been on drugs, but he was walking, staggering down the street, and two police officers were there on the video and telling him to stop. And while he's walking, one officer just starts shooting him and kills him dead there on the video. And afterwards, all the other police videos kind of disappeared, or rather, all the police dash cam videos, there were four of them, suddenly didn't have any sound on them. And they're supposed to check the sound and video before they leave the station house. And in this case, somehow, coincidentally, they all lack sound. And then a nearby security video from a nearby Burger King just disappears. This sort of thing goes on. Well, I'm sorry, it was about 40 minutes out of that video disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
These kind of controversies now occur. When people see it, you know, what was it Marshall McLuhan said? Seeing is not believing. Believing is seeing. Folks see confirmation of whatever they want to see. Now, folks who don't want to believe that something improper is going on here will find ways to believe, no, that's not what that video shows at all. And then you get this ongoing, endless argument that gets played out, again, on the Internet and other platforms where people spend more time arguing than moving towards solutions. So I think that's really a big reason why it's taken a new fever pitch.
And as you mentioned, the police in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, they had cameras on them, but you wrote in your recent column, according to police, both officers' cameras fell off during the shuffle.
Yeah.
So, really? Is that what happened? It makes you wonder. Maybe they did fall off. But
yeah, well, maybe I'm jaded by the Chicago experience.
Right.
I mean, certainly if they did have a big struggle, it's possible the cameras could have fallen off. At the same time, though, it now appears apparent that the fellow Sterling, his name was, had a gun.
Elton Sterling, yeah.
Right. He had a gun in his pocket. And one officer said that he saw the gun sticking out of his pocket, and that Alden was reaching for it, and before he could reach it, he was shot. This will have to be worked out in court and all, but because all of that was not on the video. But it makes you wonder, though, you know, because they already had him down on the ground, two officers, and did he really pose that much of a threat? But because of the rules of engagement and all, if the suspect has a gun on him or theoretically her, that usually means that the officer gets off, because that's just the way, even whether it's written in the law or the regulations or not, judges and juries tend to excuse officers who say that they were fighting in self-defense.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about this Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter controversy, because that's heating up again now, too, after the deaths of the Dallas police officers. You've written some interesting things about this, and you say that All Lives Matter isn't a slogan or a movement. You have problems with Black Lives Matter, but All Lives Matter is a dismissal. What do you mean by that, Clarence?
Yeah, first of all, Black Lives Matter. I know what they meant, but you know, again, maybe it's my marketing background or my experience with words and all. But you want to give a very clear message when you name your organization, and this one gets too easily construed in our current racial divide by people who want to say, "Well, don't all lives matter?" And get you caught up in a semantic argument that just completely leaves the issue of police conduct aside and police accountability. We saw former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani do that this past Sunday on a Sunday morning talk show, where he immediately switches the topic to saying, well, black parents need to raise their children better, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. No, these are two separate arguments. You know, I hear this all the time, and I'm not alone. You see this being played out in the papers. That's why in my column I said, okay, if all lives matter, then go out and show it. Don't just tell me that as a way of shutting me up. Show me that you think all lives matter. Get out there, get involved in politics. Show me that you really care about reforming the system, because we all are paying for police protection. We all deserve to be equally protected. And a lot of us are tired of just hearing lip service around this topic.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about guns for a moment. It has to be hard for everybody concerned here, police shootings that have taken place of those who are unarmed and those who are armed, maybe completely unjustifiably. But also police officers having to confront people with guns, guns at the Dallas police had guns. There were people who were peacefully protesting who also had guns in Dallas. There are guns all over the place, which seems...
Especially in Texas.
Exactly. Open carry in Texas, which makes everybody's job a little bit harder, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it does. And I know police aren't tickled about the open carry, and for very good reason, which I think became obvious around the awful Dallas situation last week. This is one more issue that has emerged here. It appears that black folks who take advantage of open carry get treated differently than white folks. When you see a white man coming down the street with an M16 or an AR-15 on his shoulder, do you feel differently about him than if you see an African-American man come down the street with an AR-15 on his shoulder? These are questions that, I mean, I know what the answer is as far as I'm concerned, but, you know, people who are in denial don't want to acknowledge. But I'd like to see, you know, I don't like open carry, but like I said in my column, that I'm waiting to see what the NRA has to say about this. And the NRA is studying this, I understand. And I don't think it's come up with a public statement on it. But here we've got cases where, and there's some confusion in the Minnesota case, too, that the victim's girlfriend said that he had an open carry permit. But apparently nobody could find a record of that. But nevertheless, if you've got two open carry states here where black men are killed with the excuse of them having weapons and the police officer fearing for his life, then, you know, it raises some questions about, is open carry for everybody or is it just for people with certain privileges?
Mm-hmm. And the NRA is studying this, you said?
Yeah, there was I saw an item over the weekend that Wayne LaPierre and the NRA is looking into this because they are big advocates of open carry laws. And if it appears that open carry really only applies to white gun owners, then the NRA has an interest in taking a position on this. I'm waiting to hear what they're going to say.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the New York Times has been running this front page story yesterday and today about this study done by an African-American, the youngest who has tenure, I guess, at Harvard, that looks at black men and women treated differently in the hands of law enforcement, more likely to be touched, handcuffed, pushed to the ground, or pepper sprayed. But when it comes to the most lethal form of force, police shootings, the study finds no racial bias. What do you make of that study?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
It is interesting.
I think there is a on a lot of different levels, it's hard to make a judgment about it without the context of other statistics as well. Wes Lowry, a reporter for the Washington Post, who was part of the Pulitzer-winning team that examined police shootings around the country, has a really good piece on this in a post that we reprinted in the Chicago Tribune about these statistics and how they're numerically more whites have been shot by police, but proportionally more blacks, blacks are more likely to be shot by police, put it that way. I think this statistic is the same sort of thing, that use of lethal force something that, just because lethal force is used doesn't mean somebody gets killed. And we tend to separate out those who are killed from those who are wounded.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, there are there are a lot of indicators, though, that this study and some others that similarly found that black suspects are more likely to be shot or taken into custody or charged or receive a more severe sentence for the same offense also be viewed, visualized as being older and larger than they really are, especially mm-hmm. males. This came up in the case of the 12-year-old who was shot in Cleveland last year, that he was perceived by police officers in a hurry as being bigger and older than he really was. And this has happened in a number of cases. Mm-hmm.
And Professor Fryer from Harvard said which I thought was an amazing thing that he said here, and maybe you can attest to this, every black man I know has had the experience of being punished with excessive force. It's hard to believe, he says, that the world is your oyster if the police can rough you up without punishment. And when I talk to minority youth, almost every single one of them mentions uses of force as the reason they believed that the world is corrupt.
Yes. Yes, that's unfortunately true in the cases are surrounded. This gets to the other issue, the fact that most blacks and most whites live very separate or different lives in America. Even though we work or go to the same schools, we will essentially live different lives and different experiences. My favorite example, one of my neighbors, white couple with two adopted children, both Hispanic, one of whom is Afro-Hispanic, Panamanian, and he's a teenager. And he pulled up in front of their house where he lives in his beater car. As he was getting out, a police officer that had been following him jumped out, ran over and grabbed the lad and threw him over the hood of the car.
Ooh.
and started going through his pockets. And his mother was inside the house watching. And so here comes this blonde-haired, middle-aged woman running out saying, "What are you doing with my son?" And the police officer looks up at her. And all of a sudden, his whole attitude changed when he saw her. She later was telling me and my wife that, I grew up white in a white neighborhood. I've never seen this kind of thing before. Her son was accustomed to it because we live in the Silver Spring area of Maryland there, a very middle-class, mixed area. And you wouldn't think this would be the kind of place where that sort of thing would happen, but it does.
Clarence Page is our guest, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. The question of the hour is, how do we heal this incredible and growing racial divide in this country? And how do we also bridge the gap between, as the Dallas police chief called them, the two brotherhoods, black and blue? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone lines are humming, so let's go to our first call, Richard in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Richard.
Hi, thank you. I'd like to say that there is no solution to these terrible problems, which we, the white society, and I am white, are not prepared to confront. I mean, our white society is the genocide of indigenous peoples, is slavery, is lots and lots of wars against small countries, and an apartheid society that lasted well into the 1970s. But these matters are not recognized in our public education system. They are glossed over, and we get romantic stories about the founding fathers and that sort of thing. And until our education system is willing to confront these matters, especially at the high school level, and change the understanding of our people, there is no solution to this problem.
Clarence, do you agree? Are we not learning about lynchings and the civil rights movement and slavery? Is that absent from our educational system?
I wish we were learning more about that or learning about it at all. I was astounded a few years ago when I did a column on lynching, a big exhibit on lynching pictures, postcards that used to be sold and distributed around the country back in the heyday of lynching, which were over 3,000 that are documented. And I was surprised by how many emails, phone calls, letters I got from white folks who said they had no idea that lynching was that widespread, that there was that much of it, and that the attitudes at the time, that this was so much a part of the regular mainstream culture. Whereas, you know, my experience, and my family's from Alabama originally, I grew up in Ohio, you know, I'm accustomed to this sort of thing from an early age, more so than now. But, you know, we are two different countries. We do need to know more about history, and I say this as someone who's lucky enough, me and my wife got to see Hamilton in New York.
Oh, did you?
On Broadway here a couple of weeks ago, and we're still humming the songs every day, but it's a wonderful musical for people to see. It's one that both Barack Obama and Dick Cheney love because it gives you a different side of history. It gives you, the underappreciated Alexander Hamilton, you know, first treasurer
right.
of U.S. government. In so many ways, he embodies the American spirit, and the show has done so well without sentimentality in terms that today's young people can understand because it's rap, it's rock, it's like Hair and West Side Story. It's very accessible. And we need to appreciate history more because we can both understand where we came from and how far we have to go, but also the great potential in this country for solving these kinds of problems, for making progress, for learning more about each other. Even if we fight during election years and all, when emotions are really high and the stakes are high, we calm down eventually and begin to have some common sense that begins to take over. But we have to get through these periods.
Yeah, we do. Thanks, Richard, very much. And looking at this from the law enforcement angle, I thought that the Dallas police chief had a pretty moving comment, David Brown, when he was talking about all that police officers have to do. Obviously, they have to be held accountable, and there are some bad cops out there, and they shouldn't be police officers, and we need to figure out how to get them off the force. But he talks, and I think there's some truth in this. Every societal failure, he says, we put it on the cops to solve. Not enough mental health funding, let the cop handle it. Not enough drug addiction funding, let's give it to the cops. Here in Dallas, there's a loose dog problem. Give it to the cops. Schools fail. Give it to the cops. And I think that we've also done it with schools who are they're dealing with all of these problems as well. It's kind of like there's this whole breakdown. Police officers can't handle all of those issues. Schools can't handle all of those issues.
That's very true. And that's, I wish I could remember the exact statistic, how many of our inmates in our prisons and jails have serious mental health problems.
Yes.
That are untreated except by the jails. I mean, they, literally, we have police scoop them up off the streets and throw them into the criminal justice system, which is not equipped to handle their problems. And then we wonder why we have a man who goes insane and shoots five police officers and about seven other people as well. This is the kind of issue that tends to get pushed under the rug until we have a crisis like this that comes along, and then we start talking about it. But are we going to follow up with action? So I go back to what I said in my column. If all lives matter, get up and show it.
Yeah. Dan in Boulder Junction, hi.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Dan.
I'm calling you as a former lawyer and traffic court judge. How many people know that the entire continent of North America, Mexico, Canada, and the United States, is covered by a treaty that under certain circumstances limits the capacity of all guns to no more than three shots? It's called the Migratory Bird Treaty. why do ducks and geese get 10 times the protection of our children and ourselves?
Clarence, very good question.
No, that's a very good question, Clarence. I didn't know that, did you?
No, I didn't, but it's about as crazy as so many of our gun laws. I mean, I after the shooting out there in Arizona of the congresswoman, Gifford, I wrote then, you know, why don't we restore the ban on those big magazines that hold more than 12 rounds? This won't solve the gun problem, but at least it makes it more difficult for these mass killers to kill as many people. It was while that fellow was changing magazines that he was tackled and stopped. But before they could do that, he'd already shot about a dozen people, as I recall. When I wrote that column, and then I got the predictable avalanche of mail calling me all kinds of things, right, including communist, subversive, et cetera, wanting to disarm America, hating guns, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'll tell you, I'm a military veteran. I know how to fire the M16 and the old M14 and all. I'm not scared of guns. I'm very realistic about guns, but we need to be realistic with our laws concerning weapons. And we have not, because of the politics involved.
There's also this, what happens to your psyche when you have all of these incidents one after another? You have Orlando and people mourning in this country continue to mourn what happened in Orlando. And then, you know, a couple weeks later, you've got what happened in Baton Rouge and what happened in Minnesota, what happened in Dallas. It's just one after another after another. It kind of damages the soul, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, and I'm very concerned about young people who get traumatized with this experience. Memory goes back to the 4-year-old girl in the back seat.
Yes.
During that shooting in Minnesota, and her trying to calm her mother down, "Mommy, I'm here." Mm-hmm. You know, it's just heartrending. And how many of these heartrending videos? You know, after the grade school children were killed there at Sandy Hook. Mm-hmm. Everybody thought, well, we got to see some action now, but we didn't. And now I think everybody feels more depressed about gun safety than before, because if you can't get some kind of sensible gun safety laws after a catastrophe like that, when can you ever get it?
Yeah. Dan, thank you very much for your call. Martha in Menominee, hi.
Yes, hello. I'm grateful that you are doing this show. I'd like to ask your guest. I grew up in Washington, D.C., so I'm about as, you know, white as they come. But I don't feel that I have biases or prejudices. I know deep down we do, but I'm trying to work on that. And my question is, I went on the FBI website and I looked at their definition of domestic terrorism, and it sure seems like that's what a lot of these black men are dealing with in the cities. It appears these communities are almost under siege. People act so shocked that Dallas happened, but my husband and I have been talking. We've been wondering what took so long.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the cities under siege are actually it's a separate problem from the police conduct problem. And it's like I was saying before about Rudy Giuliani bringing that up last weekend, that chances of a young black a man or boy being killed by another young black killer are much greater than being killed by a white person or being killed by a police officer. But that's a separate issue, because these street criminals are not under public employ. They don't have a public mandate or public accountability. And police officers do. But I don't want to change the subject away from the issue you're talking about, because certainly in Chicago now we've been dealing with another surge in homicides. Now, I was on the city desk back in the 1970s as a young reporter and a weekend assignment editor, and we actually had more homicides then than we do now. We went over 1,000 2 years in a row, and then that happened again in 1994, and it settled down. Crime across the country went down. Now we're having a surge in Chicago, And there's a lot of different factors. Nobody's really sure, or there's no simple answer for it. It's complicated reasons why violent crime suddenly shoots up in an area like whether it's Washington, D.C. or Chicago or New York or L.A. And we have to analyze and deal with that directly when it does happen. But it is tied in with the local sociology. But it doesn't help matters when the police and the community are at odds with each other. In communities where the cooperation with police is high and confidence is high, crime goes down. And that is consistent across the country, including Dallas.
Yeah. Well, Dallas, all indications are that the situation was getting better between the police and the community, that the crime rate was down. It's gone up in the last couple of years, and the police chief is taking some grief for that. But community policing was his philosophy, and there were all kinds of pictures of police officers and demonstrators hugging each other. And after the horrendous tragedy, there were police officers and African Americans and whites, and this sense of community, right?
That's right. And Dallas actually had been cited for very bad police practices for a long time. And then I can't remember the exact year, it was like 7 or 10 years ago, they worked with the federal government to change everything and improve police community relations. And the current chief, an African American who lost his own brother and a son to drugs and crime out there, which the whole crack epidemic caused him to decide to go and become a police officer, and he worked his way up in the force. So he's very sensitive to all five sides of this issue, and that's the kind of leadership you need. And Dallas has made that kind of progress and had actually been a model. So it was a real tragic irony that this particular calamity happened to hit Dallas.
Mm-hmm. KP has an eye on the AP because the memorial service is underway. Just your response, former President George Bush speaking just a few moments ago, we're grief-stricken, heartbroken, and forever grateful. He went on to say, at times, it feels like the forces pulling us apart are stronger than those pulling us together. Do you think so?
That's a beautiful line, because indeed it does feel that way. And at the same time, if anybody knows about forces pulling us apart and pulling us together, it's George Bush and Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Because as presidents, they each have been at the center of the storm with people on both sides. Very often very passionate, very emotional, and things can seem to get out of hand as though we're never going to resolve these issues. But it does take real leadership in terms of calming the public down, getting people to realize, hey, there's a better way of doing all this, and we can work together. And we've seen this repeatedly. You just mentioned the demonstrators and police officers who posed for selfies together and all before the sniper began to cut loose. And afterwards, we've seen thousands and thousands of people gather for these memorial services out there in Dallas. And I've been hearing from people down in Baton Rouge who are just heartbroken, black and white, over what has happened down there. And Baton Rouge is a very tight community. It's remarkable. I've always enjoyed the folks in that town, because they take this sort of thing to heart. This is like it might have happened across town. As far as they're concerned, it happened right next door. And that's the kind of spirit that you can really build on. And I can say the same about St. Paul, Minneapolis. Minnesota, nice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's their governor was the first to say that he didn't think that killing would have happened if the driver had been white. And that was a powerful statement for him to make, and it was one that I think made everybody stop and think.
Yes.
And that's the kind of real leadership that we need to have.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little history here. Deb on Facebook writes, have we completely forgotten what happened in the late 60s? Destruction of our cities in race riots, violence against nonviolent protesters, drafting young men to die in Vietnam. Talk about that mess. How soon we forget.
Yeah, how well I remember.
I do too.
I was a student and then a reporter and then a draftee at the end of the 60s there. I saw sides of it in Chicago and other cities. And, I've say to people, have we ever been this divided? I said, hey, let me tell you about the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I tell you, this past weekend, after like each day another calamity was happening, I said, this is getting to be worse than the 60s. That was just my attitude. Unfortunately, it's calmed down now, and I've calmed down. But nevertheless, we do go through this sort of trauma every so often. I think these days our politics, amped up by the age of Twitter. I have nothing against Twitter. I use it myself all the time. But we are in a different era now where demographic changes are happening in the country. And conservatives who have always had the philosophy William F. Buckley used to say, the stand athwart progress, relentlessly shouting halt, or something like that. The idea that hold on to the old values, the old America, and that's where you get slogans like "Make America Great Again." There's this mythical notion that we were better off in the 50s. The fact is, the other half of the country says, no, we weren't. And we need to look forward and help this country to be a better place for everybody. Those are deeply felt politics that are shaping our politics this year. They will have to be resolved. One way we resolve them is with an election. As we saw in the Obama administration, it was resolved on election day, but that didn't end the fighting. That was only the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that over time we're going to learn to resolve these differences, but it's going to be one step at a time.
And also during the 60s, we had those who were guiding us in many ways, Dr. Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, John Kennedy, but particularly Martin Luther King, who we lost, the voices who could speak poetically and who put their lives on the line for all the things that we're trying to achieve now so many years later, and then they were taken from us. It was just horrendous.
It was, and you're absolutely right. Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King could get up and just speak extemporaneously and have the right words. Bobby
right.
Kennedy just calmed this black crowd in Indianapolis the night he broke the news to them that Dr. King had just been killed. And you can see the video on YouTube, like everything else is on YouTube, but it's really worth watching because
yes,
he
is.
Gave this poignant little speech. And here's a man who had just lost his brother, assassinated there in 63, and he was about to be assassinated like a couple months later. And yet, at that moment, he came up with the right words for that moment. Dr. King, of course, was very eloquent in articulating the American dream in a way that puts his speech on the Mall right next to the Gettysburg Address and the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence as one of the great founding documents of this country. And yet, Dr. King was roundly hated by many people while he was alive. Tavis Smiley did a book about this, how much Dr. King had critics on all sides,
yes,
just like Obama today. So it's like this is not really that new. And I think Barack Obama, certainly after he is not president anymore, we're going to find ourselves quoting Barack Obama a lot, just like we quote Dr. King now, and saying, boy, that was real leadership in those days. When are we going to get that again?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
Clarence Page is with us. We're going to welcome more phone calls. We'll take them momentarily. 800-486-8655. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Clarence Page, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the Chicago Tribune, television political analyst, is with us to discuss Dallas and Minnesota and Louisiana and all that preceded that, violence and guns and a huge racial divide in this country. And we're welcoming your thoughts about all of this. We're also keeping an ear. I guess the president is just beginning his remarks in Dallas, so we'll glean some of the more important statements and have Clarence respond to that. David in Stoughton, our next caller. Clarence, hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Great. Interesting program. I've listened to a number of the programs that you've had on this, and I just wanted to make a few comments on things, and then I'll let you take it from there. I think that the Dallas chief is just an excellent person to speak out during these particular times. He seems to be a person who has a real feeling and understanding of policing and police situations going on. I think he's a great spokesperson and someone who looks forward to that, especially with comments where the police are drawn upon when there's no one else to do it. They load that additionally onto the police. But a couple of things that I just wanted to bring up. I listened to a program on the air that had dealt with videos and recording of videos, and it was on last week or something like that. Anyway, what they said on the video was it was the angle in which the video showed what was happening, and the example was cited where someone was standing videoing, and it looked like the police officer was fighting with the individual, but the video from another angle showed that they were dancing. So much is being relied on a video that gets broadcast over the air when it doesn't necessarily show the full
show the
extent.
Truth. Yeah, Clarence.
Yeah, that's very true, that the angle can make a big difference with these shots. And that's why you get you get to a courtroom. You have an actual investigation and examination of it all. Everybody may not be happy about it. I think about the Freddie Gray story there in Baltimore, where you got video of Freddie Gray being put into a police wagon, and then it's the last you see of him until reports that he's died in the hospital days later. And it's the prosecutor went right at what five police officers were charged initially, and each one who's come up so far has been found not guilty. Everybody's mad at the prosecutor now. The system doesn't always satisfy what you would like to see it satisfy, but these things do need to be investigated. The video is only the beginning, not the end of the investigation.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much. Somebody on Facebook, and let's just bring this up, said that we have not talked about the fact that the shooter in Dallas was a U.S. soldier, obviously an incredibly troubled U.S. soldier. There's also just this other aspect of our looking out for each other, Clarence. This guy had an arsenal in his house. He was doing military drills, evidently, in the backyard. You were so separated from each other that you just now you think, for God darn sake, didn't anybody see that there was this weird thing going on with my neighbor? Maybe he needed some help?
Well, that needs to be investigated, too, of course. And the question is, what if you did see him going through all this and you felt like something needs to be done? What do you do?
Right.
You call the authorities, but there's, you can't just say that person's crazy and then they're locked up. If they haven't done anything as far as breaking the law, and as we said, Dallas is an open carry. Texas is an open carry state, and the fact that he has weapons in itself is not enough for him to be cited or forced into some kind of therapy. And again, the laws have protected people against being unfairly committed to psychiatric care. That has to go through court as well. Let's just say that all of that needs to be examined, and in order to see if we do need to change our policies. I know my policies move toward tighter controls on who can have a gun. That's not the NRA's policy, and they carry more clout right now on Capitol Hill than I do, even though the majority of Americans support background checks, including, I understand, surveys of a majority of NRA members, because they don't want to have people who are crazy having guns either.
Right.
We're still at an impasse because our politics just aren't serving us these days.
The president has begun his remarks in Dallas. He had this to say: "We're here to honor the memory, mourn the loss of five fellow Americans, grieve with their loved ones, support their community, pray for the wounded." And this is the line I want you to respond to, Clarence, and find some meaning through this tragedy. What in the world is the meaning?
Well, you know, I'm going to have to go back and see, but he said something very similar at Sandy Hook. Mm. And of course, those are very important words. Find some meaning in this tragedy, because otherwise you just say, oh, this is so senseless. How could this happen?
Right.
Your faith is shaken. If you're a religious person, you wonder, why does the Lord allow this to happen? I mean, it's very upsetting for everybody. But what is to be our rational response to it all? And I think that's what President Obama is talking about, because who's more frustrated than him? He has had to go to more of these services than any other president. And here was a man who had great ideals and goals he hoped to achieve while he was president, but his opposition got stronger and stronger. It's the strongest anti-left backlash I've seen since the 60s, when we saw the backlash that brought George Wallace and his presidential campaign, and the Nixon race, where Nixon versus Humphrey, and Nixon won that. And this is right after Barry Goldwater lost in '64, but conservatives made their comeback in 1980 with Ronald Reagan. This goes back and forth. But these we actually had more gun controls back in the '60s than we have now. But the politics changed, and the controls loosened, and so now we have the situation that we're dealing with now.
Beverly in Ironwood, hello. Beverly? Yep, she's gone.
I must have made the point she wanted to make.
I guess so. John in Madison, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I wanted to say when it came to social media and how incredible it is and awful at the same time, that we can see these things live as they're happening and share different viewpoints and perspectives and videos and articles and information. I think that during times like these, one thing we're not looking at is the echo chamber we put ourselves in based on the pages we decide to like on Facebook, or the celebrities, or the viewpoints we choose to listen to. And so instead of broadening our perspective, we, in essence, just shut ourselves out and become more galvanized in our viewpoints and, don't expand on that. And I just thought, I would share my comment.
Thank you. I'm so glad. You have such wonderfully intelligent listeners. I just love your program. Because he's absolutely right. And somebody said the other day that the people that I talk to on the street sure do sound a lot more calm than those I see on Twitter or other social networks. That's where all the trolls come out, on the right and the left, and really go at it against each other. And you would think that what was that headline of the New York Post, Civil War, and
right.
Drudge Report had a big flashing red and blue a headline like war was breaking out. And yet you walk out in the street and the birds are still singing and the sun is still shining. And, most Americans want to do something positive in response to all of this. They want some kind of solution and action toward a solution, some way we can all find common ground and work on improving police accountability, reducing the crime rate, getting real criminals off the street. These are all common problems and common concerns, and we ought to be able to find some common solutions.
And nobody wants all of this killing, Clarence.
That's right. That's right. And it's a worldwide embarrassment for the United States, and we're not doing enough to reverse it.
Let's go. Now Beverly is with us, I think. Hi, Beverly.
Hi. I was wondering, it's like an atmosphere in this country, like, it's like almost the blacks are put in prison for an industry. They are incarcerated for crimes that they get, more time and punishment than the whites. And we see that. I mean, I have heard that anyway in the news and different,
Mm-hmm.
And also like our voting restrictions, it's like knock down the blacks, knock down the poor. And it's like the Republicans are kind of wanting this to happen. They've even kind of giggled about it. They want to, it's getting harder and harder for the minorities to vote. And of course, that's your black and your poor and so forth. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned a couple of things there. On the voter disenfranchisement issue, this is not new. And I don't want to make it too partisan, because Democrats used to do it back when they were the Southern Party and wanted to keep a lid on black political empowerment. Now we see Republicans doing it, and these are political tricks that work both that can work for either party, and either party will possibly try them, and we all need to be aware of it and get people registered to vote so that democracy can have a chance to work. But it's a trying to remember the first point she made about the high incarceration rate, mm-hmm. et cetera, and the prison industrial complex. Yeah, there's a book called The New Jim Crow, written by a wonderful law professor at Ohio State, who that's become a real bestseller across the country because it talks about the many ways after the Civil War that blacks were disenfranchised around the country and also thrown into jail and made to suffer peonage, which is a slavery by another name.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We're out of time. Clarence Page, always a pleasure. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah, pleasure always. Clarence Page, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist with the Chicago Tribune. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the hour, K.P. Whaley for on-air production. Speaking of voting, tomorrow Ari Berman will join us. He says the Republican war on voting is working, so we'll talk about that. Next hour, we'll be discussing Islamophobia, so we'll hope you'll join us for that conversation as well. If you couldn't get on the air, go to our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and let us know what you're thinking.